Fortnight in Film is a podcast where every week you get the chance to listen in on a group of film lovers chatting about the great, or not so great, movies that we've been watching over the past fortnight. Hello and welcome to episode 9 of A Fortnight in Film. I'm your host Jason.
And I'm your co-host Christian.
Thanks for tuning in. Heads up, the films we're about to discuss may contain spoilers. For a list of the movies we cover this week, check out the description. Let's kick it off with your pick, because I just finished watching this film like half an hour ago. So it's fresh in my mind to talk about.
Okay, yeah, I watched it a couple nights ago, and I was going back and forth between which movie I want to recommend, because I saw some good ones recently. I saw The Sound of Metal, which was really good. I saw A Hidden Life, which was fantastic. A couple of Miyazaki / Ghibli films. And I almost went with this 1981 film called The War of the Worlds, Next Century, by this Polish director. But I ended up going with, I had a moment where I was like, oh my God, why didn't I pick this other movie I just saw the other night? So I went with Network from 1976. Which is another Sidney Lumet film. I've actually seen a few Sidney Lumet films fairly recently for the first time. I saw 12 Angry Men, and then just before that, I saw The Offense, which was also from the 70s, although I don't remember the year. Sean Connery was amazing in The Offense. Sidney Lumet is just, he has a lot of movies, and I don't know why he's not, people don't talk about him enough. Everything I've seen so far is just unbelievable. But yeah, so we got The Network, and the basic plot. Essentially, there's a guy who is a television network anchor, like a news anchor, and he's getting kind of old, and he finds out he's going to lose his job. His ratings aren't good enough anymore, right? And it's kind of like this is the only thing that he was holding on to. But he goes on TV one night unexpectedly and says he's going to kill himself within a certain amount of time. He's like, I'm going to kill myself on the news and tune in, and I'm going to do it in like a week, and that should give the network time to prepare all the advertisements and stuff. Just really cynical guy, just kind of broken down. You know, he decides to go on and do like an apology. And of course, it's kind of like a thinly veiled fuck you to everyone. And so, you know, it's not sincere, of course, but there's this a couple like very cynical TV executives who realized that their ratings climbed when he said he was going to kill himself. And then when he went on and started just being crazy. So they exploit him and give him a show, where he just rants about stuff, about, you know, how awful everything is and et cetera. It's got this really famous scene where this is like his first mad prophet moment, which is what they kind of refer to him afterwards, the mad prophet of the airwaves. But he has this crazy scene where he is allegedly hearing voices at night, and they inspire him to get up, and he goes into the studio like in his pajamas and a raincoat, and he jumps in front of the camera and just goes on this crazy, angry, vicious diatribe. And it ends with this famous line, like, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm as mad as hell and I'm not going to take this anymore. And he tells everyone to like get up out of their seats, everyone watching TV, and to go to the windows and shout, you know, I'm mad as hell, I'm not going to take this anymore. Which, by the way, was actually ripped off by, I know you're in Australia, so I don't know if you've seen this, but there was an American commercial for, I think it was for like a lending company or something. That came out sometime in the last 5 to 10 years, and they basically ripped this whole thing off. But they had people leaning out of their windows and saying, it's my money and I want it now. And it's the exact same thing. Yeah, but it spirals into this, like he keeps going on the show and causing trouble for the network because he attacks the network with a lot of it. And they let him go because his ratings are ridiculous. But then he starts meddling in corporate decisions and tanking things that his network is trying to do to like survive fiscally, and he gets in trouble with the big guy upstairs, and that's another famous scene. But yeah, it's just this great movie where you have this guy who's unhinged and being taken advantage of by these very cynical network executives. But at the same time, in the background, you know, you see these like these diverging sort of side plots. There's some adultery here, you know, these side characters, and you know, almost feels like, I don't know, like it's not as important, like they're kind of just meandering, but really what I got from it, and this really clicked on the third rewatch, is they kind of, their problems are a direct, like a mirror reflection of all of the stuff that he is harping on them for. And at the same time, they think that they are taking advantage of him. you know, and it's, I don't know. It made me realize kind of the brilliance of the screenplay. It's so intricate. And it's so layered. What did you think? I'm eager to hear your thoughts. I didn't see if you put a review on Letterboxd. I haven't seen it yet.
I rated it 4 stars. So,
okay. I didn't see your rating, I should say. What are your thoughts on this?
No, I mean, I really liked it. I think, you know, I was just reading before we jumped onto record, I was reading a lot of analysis about the film, and a lot of analysis said it was very prescient in what it was talking about, right? Because now everything it's saying, which it sort of treats, you know, it's treated as satire in the film, but you look at it now and it's like, that's our reality. I totally agree with you about the script. I think the script was incredibly well written.
Oh, it was so good.
You know, because it had a lot of monologues.
Yeah.
There were obviously conversations, but part of it too was a lot of monologues, either from Howard when he's doing his show, or, you know, from Max, who's, you know, speaking on different things.
Yeah, Max was actually really good. He was like an underdog character that I grew to really love, or more than Howard Beale, honestly, because he's more grounded, I think.
I didn't really like the subplot of Max and Diana, but I get why it was in there, and I agree with you that it is, you know, it is a mirror to the bigger issues, right? Diana is the television industry, Max is, you know, the people in the television industry who don't want to be taken advantage of. You know, it's a representation of the bigger issues.
It did also have to grow on me. I agree with you.
I mean, because it sort of felt like two films in one, in a sense. It's like, and obviously they were connected. It just wasn't like completely distinct things, but it was a bit like I would have personally loved, and this is, I'm going to say I gave it 4 stars, obviously enjoyed the film, but what would have given a higher rating for me was if it focused more on that, like, TV aspect, and like, hey, we just exploit the negativity, and oh, he says he's going to kill himself, let's give him his show, you know, like, that whole aspect of like analyzing the media and television and what they focus on and why they focus on that, etc. But again, that's more so because maybe my background and I'm interested in the media. That's just a personal thing. I would have liked to have seen more. But no, I mean, I very much enjoyed the film. I think it's very, you know, very much a biting satire of what the news is and what the television industry is and how much that influences us. And, you know, I guess for some people, it probably, I mean, I feel like today, we're all so educated in the sense of what the media is and how they operate. I think there's a lot more transparency there than there was when this film was made, perhaps. But I do think that for a lot of people, it sort of lays out point blank, like, hey, this is how the television industry operates. This is what they do. I relate to it because I don't watch the news, purely because of exactly what they highlight in the network. All the news focuses on is negative stuff. I actually saw a thing on LinkedIn coincidentally this morning where, and it was sort of related to a different thing, I was talking about how, like, when you're in marketing, you don't have to come up with like 100 different ideas. It tied it back to the news because it was saying the nightly news, they do the same 10 stories every night. Now it was sort of exaggerating, but no, true. It's like, you know, something the party in power says, something the opposition party says, you know, some sort of crime, a murder, a rape, some sort of disaster, you know, a car crash or some terrorist thing, a war, you know, something the prime minister said. It's, you know, it's the same it's thing over and over again.
It's outrage addiction.
Exactly.
They want to get you fired up because the angrier you are and the more validated you feel, the more you're going to tune in. And actually, I like what you said about the transparency that everyone kind of is more attuned with now as opposed to how they may have been back then. I wasn't alive in 76. I can only speculate. But I feel like that helped the movie maintain this staying power, that it increased in relevancy.
Howard's shtick sort of, you know, like, it's sort of funny, right? Because it sort of got old for the network quickly. And I feel like for the audience, it somewhat got old for us as well, because it was just sort of the same thing. I mean, obviously what he was saying was different. Obviously he transitioned from talking about, like, well, he sort of went through a few different phases. He transitioned from talking about television in general and like, this is what it's doing to you, this is how they do things. Then it went on to, like you said, talking about the corporate merger and the takeover and sort of exposing things that they didn't want out. And then it went into, you know, then the head of a corporation talked to him and said, I want you to say this. And then he went into talking about, you know, the death of democracy, etc. But I felt like, yeah, like Max and Diana, as much as their subplot distracted somewhat from the point of the movie, even though it was a sort of representation of bigger things, I do think they were the two strongest characters in the film.
And I got this impression, like, the way they played off each other, they almost were representations of two sides of one argument. And you can see that just in the way that they treat Howard Beale. Because Max is like, this is a very ill man. You're taking advantage of him. He, you know, at one point he threatens to quit. He's going to tell everyone what you're doing to this man, all that stuff. And Faye Dunaway, her character Diana, could not be more the opposite.
Yeah, she couldn't care less.
Oh, she was in a hurry to exploit him to the last molecule. It seems like this almost unlikely love affair when they should, like, in terms of ideology, almost they should despise each other, and they have this sort of negative attracts relationship, but that allows for some really great arguments. Their arguments are fascinating in the way that the themes of the film are fascinating, because they differ so fiercely on how this man should be treated. And I feel like the conversation they're secretly having is like, how should we treat stuff like this? Should this be exploited? You know, should we be exploiting absolutely anything with no moral considerations if the ratings improve? And also, if the ratings improve, the more deranged this man sounds, what does that say about the audience? What does that say about us as the audience too?
Like, you know, the partnership sort of has to happen, because that's sort of indicative of TV, right? So like, there's Max, who's the old guard, who wants to tell news and facts. And then there's, you know, Diana, who's the new guard, who wants to do sensational entertainment and everything else. And really, the old guard, they have to get with the new guard's thinking, because that's, you know, like Diana says, I'm taking over your show, you know. So that's where it's going. And so he sort of either has to leave and retire, which he does, or get with the program, so to speak, and you know, go with Diana and go with her way of thinking.
And it you know, was really interesting. There was one of the lesser known, lesser talked about diatribes. Like, if you go on this movie, you plug it into YouTube, you're gonna get the initial really famous speech, like I'm mad as hell speech. You're gonna get the one, the turn off your TV speech. You're gonna get the one where the corporate guy, I can't remember his name, but the guy at the
Jensen,
and he, you're gonna get his speech where, you know, he tells him that there are no nations or democracy, you know, that speech. But one that I thought was phenomenal, and it was almost like the lines were being directed at the audience. This was a Max Schumacher line. I'm gonna quote it here. I hope you don't mind. This is when he's breaking up with Diana. It's too late, Diana. There's nothing. And when I say this, picture this like the movie or the screenwriter saying this sort of about the audience. It's too late, Diana. There's nothing left in you that I can live with. You're one of Howard's humanoids. If I stay with you, I'll be destroyed, like Howard Beale was destroyed, like Lauren Hobbs was destroyed, like everything you and the institution of television touch is destroyed. You're television incarnate, Diana, indifferent to suffering, insensitive to joy. All of life is reduced to the common rubble of banality. War, murder, death are all the same to you as bottles of beer. And the daily business of life is a corrupt comedy. You even shatter the sensations of time and space into split seconds and instant replays. You're madness, Diana. Virulent madness, and everything you touch dies with you. But not me, not as long as I can feel pleasure and pain and love. I heard that, I was like, I just need to move out into the woods, you know, turn no more TVs ever again. Like, it feels like this attack on just this insensitivity that people have that had then, and my God, is it not magnified today with the internet and memes and fucking 4chan, you know, and I mean, and YouTube. But that begs the question, like, is this the fault of the institution, or is it just something, is there just something in us as a species, you know, where this shouldn't be something that thrives, but it is, you know, we're very tribal, humans are. And so we gravitate towards things like this. We like watching the news, for example, and hearing all this bad news, but oh, it's about those other people, you know, it's not about us. Like, you know, I don't know, maybe I'm reading too much into it, but
no, I mean, I totally agree with you. I mean, but I loved that speech as well. I think, yeah, that's totally underrated, because that's really, you know, it's really this. I did find it a bit, I loved it. I did find it a bit too on the nose. Like, it was a bit too like, okay, yeah, I get it. You're telling us what the TV industry is, you know, like, but I very much loved it. But no, I totally agree, because it does, you know, it does pose the question of, you know, they're telling, and they say this in the film, they're doing news, right? Straight news, facts, that's it. And they say, oh, we've had, you know, declining ratings and we're like a $32 million deficit, blah, blah, blah. And then he starts going out and, you know, and this is where I come in, like a journalism, right? So like what a journalist should do, and I was reading an article about this a while ago about like how useful is objectivity and like why do we have objectivity and stuff. And so like what the news should do is, you know, these are the facts. I'm not presenting an opinion. I'm not saying either way, you know, what you should think. Just here are the facts as they are reported. But, you know, what sort of the film represents is, well, people aren't interested in that. They want to hear the truth, you know, in quotes. You know, they want opinion. They want someone to tell them what's really going on and sort of give power to how they're feeling and what they're experiencing.
They want to feel like they're on the winning team.
And it does pose the question of, you know, well, if we as an audience, as a society, lap all this up so much, like, what does it say about us? Because there's a reason people tune into the news every night. There's a reason that, you know, clickbait headlines will get more attention than just, may say, a factual headline.
Yeah, it's fucked up that this works. That this approach works, that it gets so much money and so many views. It's fucked up that it works. There's something about us. And you know, not to be too pessimistic, but I do think that this is a very pessimistic film.
Oh, yeah, totally, yeah.
Extremely, extremely. But that doesn't mean that it's wrong. It's kind of a downer of a film. Yeah, especially the way they toss him out at the end, too.
What? So not even toss him out, they kill him. They literally assassinate him live on television.
Well, exactly, because when his ratings tanked before in the film, all they had to do was fire him. But now they can't fire him because the guy up top said no, and I wasn't sure why that was at first, but now I think that I don't know. I get this impression now, and I haven't done any research. I don't know if this was intentional, but I get the impression that the guy would not let them take him off the air after he started tanking because he was giving him as much rope as he needed to hang himself on live TV to just have it fizzle out, this whole movement that he may have been starting. And if that's true, I think that's brilliant. Because not only that, but they, you know, the head guy gives him enough rope to hang himself with. His ratings tank. People lose interest in him. And then, you know, of course, the other executives decide to murder him because they can't remove him. That's the only way that they can remove him. That conversation they're having, it was so callous at the end where they decide that they're going to murder him. Like it was nothing. Like it was nothing to them. They could not wait to turn that slot back into profits.
Yeah, I mean, there's only that one guy who says something like, you know, this is a capital crime we're committing.
And how quickly they just brush it off, like, it is, but, you know.
Yeah, like all the other people are like, oh, well, you know, it'll give us this many more profits and it'll you know, up the ratings by this much. And like I said, obviously it's satire. Obviously nobody's going out killing, you know, news people on air because their ratings are bad. But
I don't know. Maybe if I Google it, it's happened somewhere. Dare I Google it?
I was thinking about it, and like obviously they didn't. You know, once he gets killed, the film sort of ends, and then they have these news reports talking about, oh, he was dead. You know, he's been killed or whatever. But it's. I was thinking like the audience doesn't react when he gets shot, right? Well, it's hard to tell. When instead it cuts off once he gets killed, so it's sort of hard to tell what your interaction is. But I was thinking about, like, if it went on, like, I suspect the audience would just see it as, you know, part of a show, just like, oh, it's some skit in the show, you know, because they're so, like, desensitized that they're just like, oh, this must be a gag or something.
They're the humanoids. It's that same line. War, murder, death are all the same as bottles of beer. How quickly do they get over that? You know, how quickly do we get over news reports of horrific things today? Yeah, I don't know. I gave it 4.5 stars, I think. I'm delighted to see that you gave it a 4-star review. That was, or not review, but rating.
Yes, very good pick.
Yeah, I'm relieved. And plus, I feel like there was just so much to talk about with this one. And it's very rewarding to rewatch because this is the third time I've seen this. It's just an experience every time. Every time my wife walks in, I'm like, you got to look at this scene. You got to look at this. I got to make you watch this. And it's one of those movies where it's a lot of very, memorable scenes that are glued together with filler that is just maybe not as like quote worthy, but it moves the story along nicely. It's not terribly distracting, and it really does more, I think, to carry the message of the film than the stuff you're going to, the famous clips you're going to find on YouTube with millions of views. But why don't you segue us into your pick?
A rewatch for me. I do own this film. I rewatched it on, I think, earlier this week or late last week for the first time in a number of years. So I had it rated as a 5-star film going into it, but I hadn't seen it in a while, and I was sort of hesitant about whether it would, you know, still hold up. Because I give out quite a few 5-star ratings, but, you know, if I'm rating a film 5 stars, it generally has to be, like, perfect. Or that, like, the flaws are so minimal that it's just stupid to give it anything less than 5 stars. So I had it rated 5 stars. I rewatched it, still 5 stars. And that movie is The Hurt Locker, 2008. Directed by Kathryn Bigelow, stars Jeremy Renner, Anthony Mackie, and Brian Geraghty.
I had my issues. I don't think, for me, it's not a 5-star film, but it is an excellent film. Now, I have been working so much overtime at work, I have not had time to write my review on Letterboxd. This isn't my final review, but I'm hovering between 3.5 and 4 stars out of 5. I'm eager to hear you talk about it first, and then I'm going to share the things that took me out of it a little bit. Although overall, I think it's a great film.
So, synopsis. So it follows we're officially called an explosive ordnance disposal unit. I guess for, you know, bomb diffusers, essentially, in Iraq. So it's in the Iraq War. So there's three guys, sort of a sergeant, and then there's a staff sergeant, and then there's Sergeant Sanborn, and then there's Specialist Eldridge. The original sergeant gets killed by an IED and blown up.
Yeah, wasn't that Guy Pearce, by the way?
Yes.
I'm surprised he took such a, like, a brief role. So for such a, like, a top-billed guy.
He was in the film for, like, you know what, 10? I don't even know if it's 10 minutes. 10 minutes, 5 minutes?
Yeah. He's the 4th listed on IMDb, and he was in the film for, yeah, it was like 3 minutes, man.
So then they have a new, you know, staff sergeant come in called William James. I guess the best way to describe him would be, like, cowboy. You know, he's very, I'm trying to think of the right word. I mean, reckless, you could say reckless. I think that's a bit harsh, but he's a bit,
You could say reckless? Are you fucking high? He's insane.
What? Yeah, okay.
He spends the whole movie nearly getting everyone around him killed, including himself.
Yeah, okay. We'll go with reckless.
Sorry. All right, I'm sorry. I had to jump in. Couldn't believe you said could say he's reckless. It's bananas. All right, go ahead. School buses could be yellow. I don't know.
He very much just does things his own way, disregards protocol. You know, he sort of has his way of doing things, and that's the way he does it. And he doesn't... I feel it's harsh to say he doesn't care about his team. I don't know what you call them, team members. I don't know what the army parlance is. But the people who are in his command. Because I think he does care about them, but I also think he's one for just, you know, getting shit done. And not so much following the book as such. So anyway, so it's interesting, and I'll come back to this later. It's an interesting film, but there's not really much of a plot. I mean, there is and there isn't. So, you know, the movie just basically follows them, you know, going through life in Iraq. They go and, you know, defuse bombs, and it's one of the things I call out is there's just nonstop tension all the way through, because you get this sense, you know, and I think it's one of the best war films for doing this. This constant sense of, like, anyone could be an enemy. You know, so many times when they're defusing bombs, the other guys are going around looking at all the rooftops and looking at all these people in the windows and looking at people just standing around. Because to them, they're like, any one of them could be, because this is what happens in the beginning of a film, is Guy Pearce's character, the original staff sergeant, gets blown up because there's a guy, I think one of the market stalls or whatever, with a phone, and uses the phone to blow up a bomb, which kills his character. So they're very, you know, the whole film, everyone is on edge, because, you know, they're constantly looking around for threats, and, like, you know, they've even come across, you know, a group of private military contractors from England, because they're dressed, I guess, you know, to try and blend in with the people. You know, they even, at them, you know, sort of attempt to detain them at first, because you know, they don't realize that, oh, these are actually guys on our side. You know, following on from that, you know, there's a scene there where they I think everyone in the contractors, I think all of them get killed apart from maybe one.
No, I think there's like two survivors, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, I think a couple of them get taken out, obviously, because then again, if it's a sniper battle.
I think there was three people. There was the gunner.
Yeah.
There was Ralph Fiennes. May he rest in peace. I love him. And there was another one.
Yes, yeah.
I remember the one of the British survivors says into the radio that they have two KIA, and then he like winces, and he's like, oh, it's three KIA. But there were only five guys, so, you know, still impactful.
They go and hunt, you know, for some insurgents, and Eldridge gets shot by James, because, James, you know, he's been taken away by these insurgents, and he just decides to randomly fire, like you said, reckless, decides to randomly fire and ends up shooting his own guy in the leg. Another one is a guy, you know, who has all this C4 or whatever strapped to him, and they can't save him in time, and he gets blown up. So there's not, you know, it's an interesting film, but there's not really... And this is, so the ending of the film, I'll just mention briefly. So James goes back to America. His rotation has ended. Goes back, tries to settle back into life with his ex-wife and their child. But he can't. He just, you know, he can't really acclimatize himself to civilian life again. And he signs up again. I think, I can't remember the quote he says, but when he's speaking to his son, who's only, I don't know, 1 year old or something, he says the quote of something like, "There's only one thing I can do, and that is, you know, this bomb disposal thing."
Yeah, I love that line. But it's, yeah, he said something along the lines of, like, he's like, oh, you'll grow up and you'll realize that you don't love some of the stuff you loved when you were younger, like this Jack in the Box. And he's like, and then you get to my age and realize that maybe you're at a point where you only love maybe two or three things. And then he kind of looks at him and goes, for me, I think it's just one thing. And then it just transitions to him basically going back to Iraq. He's just this adrenaline junkie, and it ties in so well to that opening quote that it's completely escaped me, but it's something about, you know, war being a drug and addiction aspect for some people who just can't stay out of it. Yeah, you see him at home where he's trying to talk to his wife and he's telling her stories, and then he immediately segues into like, well, you know, they need bomb disposal experts, and then all he's just back.
So I think it's a fantastic film, but it's interesting in that it said it doesn't really have a plot as such, right? So if I look at some of the other war films I've seen, you know, something like Saving Private Ryan has action driving the story forward. And the whole point of that film is they're going to, as the title says, try and save Private Ryan. Whereas, you know, a lot of the other war films that I've seen and enjoyed, they don't really have a plot. I mean, obviously there's things happening that you know, progress the story, but there's not a specific purpose to the narrative. So, like, I think the Hurt Locker is a great example. There's not a story as such. It's just a sort of snapshot of these bomb disposal experts in Iraq doing their job. I think Full Metal Jacket is similar. I mean, I hold Full Metal Jacket up as like the best war film ever, like one of the best films ever. Like, I'm like the biggest Kubrick fanboy. So, like, Full Metal Jacket is the same, right? It's not really a plot. It's just for, you know, showing these guys in Vietnam, you know, going through the war. You know, a few other films do the same thing. One of my favorite films, 1979, All Quiet on the Western Front. I think that's a great film. Similar thing, just shows this group of German guys going off to World War One. From Here to Eternity, a great 50s film, which I rewatched, I think, last week. Similar sort of thing. I mean, that does have a bit more of like plots, but again, it is just sort of a snapshot of these guys living on the base and what they get up to. So, you know, a lot of great, I mean, there's others like I mentioned, Dunkirk, you know, that does the same thing. Even, you know, even biopics like, you know, The Pianist, which I absolutely love.
Oh my God, Pianist is just amazing.
Incredible. Or like Hacksaw Ridge, right? They're both movies about true stories and true people. But even that, you know, it's just sort of showing their lives, right? So I think what The Hurt Locker and all these other films I just mentioned do so well is you don't really need a typical plot. You know, you don't need, okay, we're starting at point A and the purpose is to get to point B. You can just sort of show life in Iraq or Vietnam or World War One or World War Two or whatever. And if the characters and the action and the script and the cinematography and the acting and all this stuff is good enough, it'll be a great film. And I think that's what The Hurt Locker does well. It brings all that stuff together, and it doesn't really need a point, right? It doesn't need a story. It doesn't need a narrative.
I don't know. I'm a little thrown by how you're saying like that there's no like plot, that there's no narrative. I feel like you're downplaying it a lot. I feel like it's very much a character study. It sets kind of the expectation with when it first starts, where it shows the countdown of the duration of their tour. And then towards the end, of course, when he goes back, it says, you know, 365 days, like that's the new tour. There is a narrative where it is perhaps simplistic, but it showcases a lot of things. It first and foremost, of course, it shows or attempts to translate for an inexperienced, like an audience inexperienced in war, what it's like. It, you know, it touches a bit on the boredom and the waiting and the way, you know, friends bullshit with each other, the randomness of like how easily you can die. Some of the stuff you mentioned also about the uncertainty of your surroundings, and you just never know if, you know, some guy with a video camera in the distance is filming you for YouTube or because he knows something's going to happen. So it's very much a character study and an environment study. I do think that there was enough of a plot in there that I don't know that you can dismiss it so easily. I was excited to talk about the thing you roped in almost immediately, where he's talking to his son. And he says, like, I guess there's kind of like one thing, maybe for me, it's just one thing that I love. He's not talking about his son is the obvious implication, but you see this addiction quality in him, this recklessness that he doesn't do it for duty. Like, he wants to be there. He wants to be doing these things. He loves this rush.
Yeah, and actually it's good to contrast that against Anthony Mackie's character of Sanborn, because he even says at one point, actually after the guy who has all the C4 strapped to him, after he gets blown up because they can't save him because he's got all these, you know, pounds of dynamite on him, and then it's locked with, it's got all these locks on, you know. And
oh, that was a hard scene. Yeah.
Yeah, James comes over and he's, you know, he cuts one lock with bolt cutters, but then there's like six more, and he's just like, I can't, you know, I don't have enough time. I can't get to you. And Sanborn says after that, he's like, I can't do this anymore. You know, like, I want to go home. I want to have a child. Like, I can't be around this anymore. Whereas for James, it's the total opposite. Like, obviously he's affected by it. I'm not saying he's a soulless person who sees a guy get blown up and thinks, oh, sign me up. But to your point, like, he's addicted to it, right? Like, other people, you know, they see things happen and they're like, I'm done. Whereas he sees things happen and he's like, well, what else do I have? You know, this is my life.
Yeah. And there was this, and what, yeah, when Anthony Mackie's character, Sanborn, is saying that, like, I want a son and everything, the way that Will looks at him, like, he can't relate to him.
Yeah. And he has a son.
Yeah. And he's trying to, like, he says, like, how do you do it, man? How do you do it? He's like, fucking man, I don't know. Like, you're waiting for this. As an audience, you're waiting for this very, you know, profound thing that he's about to share, this secret to his the way he is and the way he's able to tackle these situations. And there's nothing. It's just nothing there. He doesn't think about these things.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what he says. He says, oh, how do you deal with it? I just don't think about it.
Yeah, exactly.
And he's like, what? It's like, how can you not, you know, how can you not think about it?
But you see it in his face, this moment of like, there's, yeah. You know, that was a very realistic response too. Like, he just couldn't relate to the guy. There's nothing profound. It doesn't feel written by a screenwriter. It's just this character like, oh shit, my comrade's going through some stuff and I'm having trouble relating. So I'm just going to throw out this response. I try to still think about it.
Well, I think too, I mean, not that I've ever, you know, served in the military.
Nor I.
But I think that, you know, people, and this is obviously, you know, guessing, but people join up for different reasons, right? There's some people who join up, you know, to defend their country. There's some people who join up because...
For college. College is a big one. I know a lot of people went to the military. College is it's a big one.
You know, so, and I think for him, you know, maybe he joined up, like I'm sure a lot of people do, to find a purpose. Maybe he, you know, he's found that purpose. To him, his purpose is disposing bombs. Right? I forget the number he puts out at some point. It's some ridiculous number. I don't know if it's 300, 500, 800.
It's like 873. It was literally almost 900. It was bananas. I'm like, that many? There aren't that many bombs in the world. Come on, like,
and maybe it didn't maybe touch on it so much because it's obviously not a story on him, such as a story about the broader, like you said, a character snapshot of a environment snapshot. But you know, maybe it's a thing of where, you know, he's found his purpose, and we obviously don't know what his life was like before the army. You know, whether he was lacking a purpose then, but like. Like you said, like he can't see himself being a dad, you know, a husband, just a normal. His purpose, his love, is being in the army, defusing bombs, being in that environment. He can't function any other way.
Yeah, and there was such a sharp contrast too, where they've been showing him in this environment where he thrives for most of the movie, and all of a sudden you see him. There's no transition. It's just a flash, and all of a sudden he's back in a supermarket. How mundane it suddenly feels to be in like a supermarket. You know, you're transported to this new environment and you feel like a fish out of water, just like he does, because you've been somewhere else for fucking 90 minutes or whatever it is. And you feel it. It was such a great way to express this just pointlessness, this feeling of like mundane safety. There's no threats anywhere. You don't have to look at the top of the aisles looking for someone with a gun. You know, he just, it just feels bland and uninspired and uninteresting.
And I think that's sort of a point that, you know, Catherine Bigelow is going for was, you know, it's probably discontent is maybe too strong of a word depending on the person, but like.
No, I think it's a pretty good word in this context, of course, yeah.
Like, but, you know, yeah, like, but sort of discontent, the listlessness that they feel, yeah, when they go back to civilian life, they're like, what am I supposed to do? Just get a normal job?
Yeah, and that's where he feels out of place, is at home.
Because they've been doing this epic, you know, they've been defusing bombs, they've been saving lives. You know, if you want to take it to the extreme, they've been delivering freedom.
You're Australian, you don't need to toe the you don't need to toe the American patriotic line.
I'm like the most anti-war person ever, so I'm by no means endorsing it. But like, you know, they've gone from this epic. I mean, it's not even a career; it's like a responsibility, like this. You know, requirement for their country, and now they're like, oh, I'll just get a job as what, you know, in sales, as a mechanic, as, you know, working in a supermarket. Like, not anything wrong with any of those jobs, of course, but in their mind, they can't, you know, how can that ever compare to what we've experienced over, you know, over in war? And another thing I'd call out, which I've read a lot about in terms of it's a similar thing with professional athletes when they retire. You know, a lot of them say, And I think the film did a good job of showing this, although James never really got to this point with his team because he was so different to them. Although it was a bit of a breakthrough as the film went on. But a lot of professional athletes say when they retire, they're like, you know, I don't really miss the game. I mean, some of them do miss the game, but they say, I don't really miss the game. I just miss the locker room. You know, I miss being around the guys and, you know, having that brotherhood, etc. And I think that's probably the same for you know, William James, right? Because he doesn't really, he's very much, you know, portrayed as this loner sort of character. You know, he's just, I mean, much like he's sort of willing to go off and do his own thing, he's more willing to just sort of hang out by himself.
But you do see those moments of tenderness when they need to, when they're useful.
To come back to your point, I mean, yeah, obviously, you know, the story is it's a snapshot of war and it's a snapshot of these people in war. And I think it is, you know, like if I go to my war films ranked list, you know, it's one of only five films on there that I've given 5 stars to.
What, is there anything you didn't like about it?
No, like this thing, I can't really say. To me, it's like 5-star, you know, perfect film. I can't really.
Not even the guy having a seizure behind the camera sometimes? Because that bothered me a little bit. I don't know. Maybe it's just me. I don't like shaky cam. It takes me out a little bit. There weren't as many quick cuts as I usually see with like shaky cam like that, but it was there.
I can't really remember when it was used as such. I seem to remember it was being used maybe when he was in the suit or something. And it sort of shifted from, you know, a third person view to like a first person view. I have a feeling it was used like when they were running down the streets looking for the insurgents or something. It didn't particularly bother me, but no, really, there's like, I loved, you know, everything about it. I will say, and I'm curious to get your thoughts on this, if you have any, because it's sort of a minor thing.
Buddy, I always have thoughts.
Even upon rewatch, this scene came and I was like, and I remember thinking this when I first watched it, and I was like, what does that mean? And then I rewatched it and I'm still like, what does that mean? There's a boy, I'm not a street boy, I don't know what you call him, but this boy called Beckham.
The vendor.
Yeah. He sells DVDs and stuff. Anyway, he one day, disappears from the sort of marketplace. One of the guys tells Will, where to go and find him or something. He goes there. Beckham isn't there. Anyway, the film goes on and they go into this warehouse where there's all these explosives, and Beckham presumably is there dead, and he's been made into this like body bomb, right? I guess he had his insides cut out or something and implanted with bombs. I didn't really want to look at it too long because it was quite a gruesome scene.
That's exactly what it was, yeah.
And I can't remember what the exact moment was, but later he has, like, Beckham, presumably, comes up to him again, and he's like, hey, like, you want to buy some DVDs? And it's like, you're supposed to be dead. So then I'm confused, like, so did Will get it mistaken, and the person who was body-bombed was not Beckham? Or like, was the Beckham who came back, like, a hallucination? Like, I was confused as to what that was. I didn't get it.
So my take, which may or may not be correct, I did not have as much time as I would have liked to really dig into this, but my take was that he was mistaken. The boy on the table was not Beckham. And the reason that he turned away from the real Beckham at the end was because he had already gone through this emotional grieving process and could not, I don't know, just couldn't compute maybe that he was actually alive. He had already sort of emotionally detached himself from that because he couldn't find the resolution that he wanted. He had already emotionally detached himself. He didn't have the capacity or perhaps the inclination to reinvest in someone that he thought was dead. I mean, what an adjustment, first of all, to have the most emotional standout moment of this character, his presentation in the whole film, the most emotional development you see, and then to see that so suddenly reversed, I don't know that you could predict that kind of reaction in a person. And to see him just turn away from it and just be like, I've already moved past this. I've already had my moment and I've put it back in the box and I'm done with it. I can't take that back out.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I was always just curious as to whether it was supposed to be like let's say the body was Beckham on the table, and it was supposed to be this like hallucination thing, and it was sort of talking about like, I don't know, the effects of war. I mean, I don't really know, but
I see where you're coming from. But don't give Hollywood too much credit when they do like a hallucination scene like that. It's so overt.
Yeah,
it's
true.
It's seldom very subtle. If that were the case, it would be so subtle as to be, I would say, poorly communicated. But again, I may be wrong. I might go on IMDb and be like, oh yeah, the hallucination scene. I'm like, ah, fuck.
I do agree with your interpretation. I think it was, like you said, in his mind, he was like, you're dead. I've processed this. I've moved on. So to see him again, it's like, well,
yeah, like literally, he's like, he's dead to me. This is a shocking moment, but he's dead to me. I can't let this get to me again. I've already moved past this.
But no, yeah, really, I can't say much more else about this film. I loved it. It's just, yeah, fantastic. Did you have any other points you wanted to make?
Were you not bothered by the complete lack of oversight for this unit? I've never been in the military. I can't imagine that it's this lax in oversight. Who, first of all, who the fuck does Jeremy Renner even report to? If they exist, you don't see them. He literally just does whatever the fuck he wants.
Yeah, and there's a good point, because the military is very like hierarchical and structured, and like, yeah, I can see where you're coming from.
In my job as a healthcare provider, I mean, if I do some reckless stuff, I can't tell you how many things come crashing down around me. And I'm not even in the fucking military. I can't imagine that this would be allowed.
The only option I'd offer as to why you don't see it, well, I think there's two reasons. I think there's the sort of in-movie reason, there's the out-movie reason. So I think the in-movie reason is probably because they seem to be a very sort of self-sufficient unit, in a sense. And they seem to be, well, they are a very specialist unit. So I guess they're not, a typical company in the military sense of the word, where they're sort of, going out on patrol, or they're going out on doing this or the other. I guess they're very specialist in that they're called in when there's a bomb or a suspected bomb, and they, that's their job. So I guess they're sort of, just sent out to do things.
Yeah, would you logically assume, though, that they would be so hard on procedures and stuff because you need to protect that level of experience? Maybe I'm reading into it too much, but it bothered me that I'm like, ah, man, someone's going to yell at him eventually. Like,
No, yeah, I can see where you're coming from. I do agree. I think for me, I sort of rationalized in the sense of, yeah, they were this sort of self-sufficient, autonomous unit who did this very specialist role, and they were called in to do this specific job when needed, and the army would just send them out to do it, and that was it. And they just trusted they'd get the job done, presumably, and not that James was in the unit when he did these 873 things or whatever, but, you know, presumably they've also been doing the same thing. Like, they've just been going in, defusing bombs, getting the job done, coming back. I think the out-of-movie reasons, I think that's for, like, you know, in-movie reason in terms of a film. I think the reason for us as the audience was probably to highlight the recklessness of William James, right? Because, like you said, if they had a supervisor or a commanding officer or whoever, he wouldn't be able to probably get away with half the shit he does.
Oh my God, no one, I can't imagine anyone would get away with half the shit he does.
Because, but you know, he said there's no oversight, there's nobody saying like, hey, I mean, you know, the person who tells him not to do that shit is Sanborn, who technically is underneath him, right? So,
but it's like, come on, the military must have some rules.
I mean, and I would be curious to hear, I did read that, you know, people in the military, or people, more so people who worked, you know, in the sort of bomb disposal, said that, you know, it wasn't particularly accurate. I mean, they called out some things as correct, but they said that overall, like, oh, this wasn't accurate, that wasn't accurate, which, fair enough, I can accept. He said if they'd had someone there sort of riding his ass, being like, hey, you can't do this, you can't do that, blah, 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 we wouldn't have been shown that side of him. And thus, you know, the film wouldn't have gone where it went, because so much of what happens is due to his sort of drive and his sort of, well, I'm going to do this and this is what I want to do and we're doing it. Whereas obviously if you had a commanding officer, they would actually maybe be smart and be like, actually, no, that's not a good...
You yeah. rein them in like yeah. a little bit. Yeah, they gave them this like infinitely long leash in the screenplay so that they would be able to justify having these crazy standout moments to increase the, or maintain the interest of the audience. But I don't know, maybe I've been yelled at too many times in my life. I'm just like, I feel like someone should be yelling at this fucking guy.
I mean, you're not wrong. There were times too when I was like, as much as I admired that like cowboy aspect of him, there were times I'm like, can you just like do things normally for once? Like, do you have to like go out of your way to like...
It's basically Top Gun on the ground. I mean, if you think about it.
Yeah, it's a good analogy.
I like that. Actually, I'm trying to describe this from now on. It's Top Gun, but it's not in the air.
See, that can be your review. Just put Top Gun on the ground, and it's a joke review. It's short, you'll get like 1,000 likes. Like, I guarantee you.
Let me tell you, I'm not such an attention whore that I need to lower my standards to get likes on fucking Letterboxd. No, I mean, my reviews are well thought out, and I try to keep them concise for the 3 to 5 people that read them.
Yeah, mine are also well thought out. They're just not concise at all. They're like 10 paragraphs, hence why nobody reads them. But that's okay.
Nah.
All right, so let's move on to our final topic of the episode, which has been selected by you.
I just thought I'd just keep this like super informal and kind of half serious. I'm being completely serious. Very divisive topic in the film community. You either have like a meme opinion on it where you jump onto the meme waves about this guy, or you have actual like strong opinions on him. And I'm curious to hear what you think. But Nicolas Cage, where are you on Nicolas Cage?
I would point out, and I don't know if I'm somewhat stealing your thunder here, but I would point out that his name, well, I mean, a lot of people's names in the movie industry, not their names, their stage names, but he's actually a Coppola. I believe he's the nephew of Francis Ford Coppola, who obviously directed Godfathers. So yeah, he's actually the nephew of... So his real name is actually Nicolas Coppola, not Nicolas Cage. Maybe changed it because a lot of people don't want, you know, the stigma of, you know, having to live up to a certain name or whatever. Anyway, so I just thought I'd point that out initially because a lot of people don't know that about him. So I was looking, I've only seen a couple films he's been in.
I feel like he's kind of hard to escape.
I know, he's in a lot of things, but I looked on Letterboxd yesterday, he's only in 2 films I've seen. So I've seen Con Air, which, you know, Con Air for me, it started out good, and I enjoyed it, and I was like, oh, this is like a really cool action movie, and like on a plane, and the prisoners have escaped, and oh, this is really exciting. And then it just did what it always, every action movie does. And it's, I keep watching action movies and I keep not liking them because they all do this. And they all just veer into the ridiculous over the top. And I was like, this is such bullshit. So I think I ended up giving it like 2 stars or something. But it started out as like a 4-star film for me. I'm like, oh, this is really great. And then just devolved as the time went on. So I've seen him in that. And then I've seen him in Kick-Ass.
Oh, I forgot he was in there. Yeah.
I would say that I think Chloe Moretz is sort of steals the show in that regard more than
yeah, he does. I agree.
So like I do have on my watch list Pig, which came out this year, and I do have Raising Arizona on my watch list as well, and I do own Gone in 60 Seconds. I haven't got around to watching yet, so like there are a few of his other films I want to check out. Yeah, I haven't, and said it surprises me that I haven't seen other films he's in, because like I said, he's in so much stuff.
I'm absolutely stunned. Yeah, I'm stunned. He is a phenomenon of his own. I mean, oh my God. Well, the thing is, he's done like every kind of role. My wife and I talk about, my wife and I like had to discuss it, but we settled on both of us like that we love him. And sometimes it's ironically, but sometimes it's not. I've seen a lot of his movies. I mean, he has done roles that you cannot make fun of. Adaptation was one where he is ridiculous in that movie, but that's not him, you know, that's the role he was given, and he acted the shit out of it. Funny when he needs to be, and he's serious when he needs to be, but you can kind of find funny and serious in every role he's done, except Face Off. That was entirely silly. That's this one of the silliest goddamn performances I've ever seen. He gives 110% like in everything he's in. It's like, I don't know, he's one of those people who like will take any role, but everyone else, I feel like it's for the money, and for him, I just feel like he loves his job, honestly.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of films of his that he's in which, you know, are highly rated, so like, well, at least on Letterboxd, but like, you know, Adaptation is sitting at a 4 stars on Letterboxd, which is damn hard to get a 4-star average. You know, Pig is highly rated, Raising Arizona, Wild at Heart.
Oh, Wild at Heart's a really good one.
Leaving Las Vegas, Bringing Out the Dead, which is a Scorsese film.
I have been meaning to watch that film for a long time, Bringing Out the Dead.
Lord of War, I've heard is good.
Yeah, I watched that recently. That's a good one.
Bad Lieutenant, I've heard is good. You know, he's in highly acclaimed films, and he's, you know, I think in certain roles, in certain films, he's sort of talked up as, you know, hey, he's a really good actor. But I think he is, like you mentioned, he is...
He's a living meme. He's hilariously eccentric, yeah.
He sort of transitioned from this actor into this meme, right? He's reminiscent of, and this might not be the best analogy because I think the person I'm about to mention is more highly regarded as an actor, but he's sort of like Keanu Reeves in a sense, because he's sort of a meme as well now. But I do think people think of Keanu Reeves as a better actor than Nicolas Cage, whether that's true or not.
Really?
Well, that's the sort of opinion I get. I mean, again, I haven't seen Keanu Reeves in a lot of things, so I don't care either way, but
Nicolas Cage is, Keanu Reeves is often lambasted as being a bad actor. Like, he's not good at it, but people love him anyway.
Really?
Yeah, he's, and I don't think he's a bad actor. I think that very often I see him in roles where, yeah, I admit he underperforms, but that's almost not the issue. The issue is I just see Keanu Reeves. I love Keanu Reeves, too. I love Keanu Reeves. I do. I unironically do. I'm totally on the... Loving Keanu Reeves is like loving pumpkin spice at Starbucks. I mean, you're basic as shit. You know, it sounds like you're just riding the wave. Like, I love that stuff. I love Keanu Reeves. And I'm very basic. So maybe I'm just in that crowd, and that's a weakness for me. But I do unironically really like Keanu Reeves.
Yeah, I mean, I always felt like the prevailing sentiment, and not that he's up there with, you know, the greatest actors ever, I always felt like the prevailing sentiment was that he was a pretty good actor. But again, that's more so, I guess, what I've heard from other people, not so much what I think, because I've only seen a few films.
One of the things that Keanu Reeves is famous for in a positive light is he's just like the nicest fucking guy in Hollywood. Just as a person, he's just a magnificent human being, and he's like the best of us. What I hear of him, I mean, that sounds about right. I don't know how much of this is embellished, but everything I hear and see about the guy, like, no one has a bad word to say about him. He's just this incredible human being. But I don't know. Bring it back to Nicolas Cage. He just
yes, sorry.
No, that's okay. That was a welcome diversion. Honestly, Because Nicolas Cage, it's hard to quantify him. He's done some real stinkers. Like, he's done some bad movies. But here's the thing. I don't think he cares. I don't think he gives a shit. And that's why he's so funny to talk about. Like, Community, they did that episode where... you ever see Community?
I haven't, but I know of it. Yeah.
You have done yourself a disservice, my friend. Yeah, you need to check that out. But there's one of the characters, Abed, is a film freak. He loves film. And he decides he's going to give a presentation on Nicolas Cage. And I think he, in the story, like, he watches all the Nicolas Cage films. And he goes into the class, and he has like a 1,000-yard stare. Like, he looks like a fucking crazy person. He looks like Charlie Day in the mail room, you know, where he's just losing. He's totally unhinged. He hasn't slept in a week. He's got this binder full of like disheveled papers, and he just has like a mental break trying to describe Nicolas Cage, trying to understand him. Like, is he a good actor or isn't he? And it just breaks him mentally. Like, 'cause he can't, it's like this unknowable, like, universal truth that should be hidden from mankind forever. Like, this is why we build telescopes to find the answers, and the secret answer to life is Nicolas Cage good or not? And it just made me laugh. And it's so perfect too, because that's kind of how I think about him. Because he's just undefinable. He'll take any role. He killed, like, you can't dislike him for it. He kills it. His performances are over the top when he can get away with it. And I think he probably has more fun doing that. I don't even think that's deniable. But then he'll do stuff like Lord of War, where this is not like a joking performance. He's not bad. Like, he's a pretty good actor. He does a good job.
Very, very versatile.
He's extremely versatile. And not in the sense like he's a chameleon, like Joaquin Phoenix. Like, Joaquin Phoenix, I'm incapable of seeing Joaquin Phoenix in a role. I only see the person he is being. And Nicolas Cage, similar to Keanu Reeves, like, I always see Nicolas Cage. It almost increases my enjoyment, where I'm like, oh, it's Nick Cage. What kind of shit is he going to do this time? You know, like, and not like a freak show, like I'm making fun of him. I mean, he's very fun. I have a great time watching him, but isn't that kind of the definition of entertainment? I mean, I'm extremely entertained by him. Extremely entertained.
Well, I think that wraps up episode 9.
I think that was a pretty good episode. We really delved into the meanings of these two films. And Nicolas Cage. Nicolas Cage, the unknowable.
Thanks, everyone, for tuning in.
Yes, thank you very much.
George will be back next week once he's returned from the sunny climes of Portugal.
I'm so envious.
The three of us will be back on for our group episode of the month in 2 weeks' time. So we'll look forward to that. We'll see you next week. Bye.